Children are a blessing from God, but when parents reject and ignore His wisdom and teaching about parenting, children can grow up to be a curse to their parents and to the world around them. What does the Bible say about parents and children, education, and child discipline? Pastor Bob Enyart covers this powerful and critical topic in his teaching series, Raising Godly Children. Order by calling 800-8-ENYART or online at kgovstore.com.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Enyart.
And I'm Fred Williams, creation speaker and software engineer.
Fred, I'm so excited because we have a lot of news to cover.
A lot of science news, right?
A massive black hole found nearby. We'll have to talk about that.
Yeah, 10 billion times the size of the Earth's sun.
That'd be big. Now, they're thinking they're going to be able to clone a mammoth.
A woolly mammoth.
Yeah, the woolly mammoths that had no wool, right? That's a fairy tale to explain why we find them all up at the Arctic Circle. They had no wool, but they're mammoths. Some of them were frozen. And also, they have been finding proteins in these mammoths, so we could talk about that. And Aaron Ra, that atheist, challenged me when I said there were thousands, over a million probably, of mammoths that were buried up around the Arctic Circle. And he said, no way, you know, maybe a dozen. So I've got the information on that.
Okay.
So we could talk about that. And then, you know how we have our Trochlea challenge to P.Z. Myers, and he responded and said, I don't know, which was very honest of him. Well, we have a new challenge that we're trying to formulate, and maybe the audience could help us. We'd love input on this. It's the Richard Dawkins Color Vision Challenge, from monochromatic to dichromatic. How could these stages evolve if, as Dawkins and Darwin said, evolution only happens in small steps? So how do you get from mono 1 to dichromatic 2? There's no small steps in between there that would confer survival advantage. And then there are other fascinating topics we could talk about, including earthquakes and the Bible, the topic of tonight's presentation at the Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship.
That's right. At 7 o'clock tonight, be sure to be there. It's going to be a real interesting talk, again, on earthquakes in the Bible. And that's at Wadsworth and 32nd Bethlehem Church, the little chapel.
Amen. Fred, the journal Nature has an article this week that astronomers have discovered just monstrous black holes. They found in a nearby galaxy, this Miser 87 galaxy, a black hole that they say has the mass of 6 billion suns of our suns, 6 billion. But Fred, they've found some that they believe are even far more massive than that.
Yeah, 10 billion times the size of the Earth's sun.
10 billion. Now, this is difficult for us to comprehend.
It's big and right? It's heavy. This is heavy stuff.
Heavy stuff. The thought is, when a star goes through its life cycle, when it dies, it collapses upon itself. And the gravity becomes so enormous that not even light can escape.
Nothing gets out.
So it's a black hole.
So you can't go into one and go back in time or go to different parts of space?
No, we don't believe
that. It's not like warp drive.
I don't believe that. No warp drive, no time travel. But you wouldn't want to cross the threshold of the black hole gravity boundary, because then you're in and that's it. You're not coming out. Although Stephen Hawking recently said he wants to change his view that maybe matter can escape a black hole. But to get to the size of these things are massive and far beyond what we would expect just by thinking through the Big Bang standard model of the secular origin of the universe concept. But Fred, I've been noticing that this is a pattern.
And we found other big things in space, right? Things that are unexpected.
Really big, and things that are too big for gravity to have formed them. And that's not according to young Earth creationists like you and me. That's according to atheistic, secular cosmologists, NASA, and so on. Do you remember the debate we had on the age of the Earth with a geophysicist and a mathematician?
Oh, absolutely.
CU?
And you sell the debate, and they don't. So that's an indication of who won.
At least who thinks they won. We sell the debate, the age of the Earth debate. You could get it at KGOV.com or call us at Real Science Friday, and our phone number 1-800-8-NYARDS.
Did you talk about superstructures?
We talked about superstructures, and here's what's happening. Astronomers are finding structures that are made up of galaxies. Galaxies. And these galaxies, as in thousands and millions of galaxies, and they're forming different kinds of structures. They're multi-galaxy structures, and they form walls, great walls,
okay,
and bubbles of galaxies, and filaments like strings of galaxies. And Fred, I know that atheists listening to us right now would have a tendency to discredit whatever we say because we believe in God's word. So I have a couple quotes from science news from just the last 10 years or so. But they talk about these walls and these superstructures. And let me share a couple of these quotes with you. This is from Science News in the year 2000. The Sloan Great Wall of Galaxies. So that's a name given to this.
The Great Wall of Galaxies. Okay.
The Sloan Great Wall of Galaxies, a clustering of galaxies that stretches 1.3 billion light years across. It's the largest cosmic structure ever found, and it might violate the accepted model of galaxy evolution. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a big thing for them to say, you know what? Maybe our model of galaxy evolution isn't valid. But why would they say that? Because of these other quotes explaining how gravity cannot form these structures. Here's from
science. They can, but it would take, obviously, trillions upon trillions of years, right? It doesn't fit their timeline.
It doesn't fit. If the universe is 14 billion years old, then gravity only has about 14 billion years to work.
And when you say structure, I mean, I picture design. Things are coalescing, right? I mean, it's possible that somehow they randomly attract.
Well,
but
yeah, but like a bubble, why would the Big Bang model wouldn't predict that there would be bubbles of galaxies?
Yeah. So shaped like a sphere.
Like a sphere.
Yeah.
And it wouldn't predict walls, a great wall of galaxies or strings of galaxies. Listen to this quote from Science. This goes back now, let's see, 1994. Speaking of these superstructures, gravity cannot, over the age of the universe, amplify irregularities enough to form huge clusters of galaxies. Gravity can't do that. You would need orders of magnitude more time for gravity to start to attract these galaxies into these superstructures. And this goes way back. Speaking of the Great Wall of Galaxies, this is Science, 1987. And these quotes would be out of date if there was something more newly discovered that answers this dilemma. But we assert that there was not. And so an atheist would have to say, oh, no, look what they found in 2008. But they're not going to be able to do that. Here's this quote. The theorists know of no way the Great Wall could have condensed in the time available since the Big Bang. They know of no way that could have happened. So the creationist would say that when you look at the details of the universe, of the solar system, of life on Earth, those details will constantly expose the fallacy of the secular origins theories.
It will, and it will show God's handiwork, its design. There's no question about it. We find this all the time, right?
Yeah, and there are so many examples of this here in our own solar system, of examples of God's design. Like if the solar system resulted from a gas cloud, a nebula condensing, it was spinning, it condensed into the sun and the planets, then the sun would have 98% of the spin of the solar system and the planets would have 2%, but the reality is the opposite.
That's right. That would violate a law of physics, right? The conservation of angular momentum.
Yeah, exactly. And so what that tells us is here is a massive observation. This isn't like a crater on Mercury. The spin of the entire solar system is the opposite of what the atheist cosmologist would expect it to be.
Yeah.
And so that is powerful evidence that their theory of how the sun and the planets formed is incorrect.
Yeah. Well, there's this law of physics. a merry-go-round is a good example. You got kids on a merry-go-round. You spin it really fast.
Too many lawyers.
Get a lot of lawyers on there and spin them off.
No, Fred, there are no longer parks with merry-go-rounds in them because there are too many lawyers.
Huh.
And the kids might get hurt and scrape a knee. So the, what else do they call those things? Not merry-go. Do they call them merry-go-rounds? You spin.
Yeah.
Right?
So, and let's say you fall off the merry-go-round and all these kids are falling off. Will they fall at the same spin?
Same spin.
Spin the same direction. So you're spinning, let's say, clockwise.
Like if you put a soccer ball in the middle of one of those things.
Now, I think we stick with kids. Teenagers, how about that?
If you put a teenager and a soccer ball in the middle of one of those things and you spin it, then the ball is going to start spinning in the same direction that you've spun the whole playground device.
Yeah, and if you get the teenagers to fall off, they will spin off in the same direction.
They will be spinning.
It's a law of physics. They will not ever spin the opposite direction or else it would violate that law.
Now, you could have different spinning bodies hit one another and have different kinds of interactions, but you're not going to get Venus rotating backwards. You're not going to get half a dozen moons rotating backwards.
Yep.
You're not going to get the sun to stop spinning and the planets take all the spin of the nebula. So these are massive observations of the broadest details of the universe and the solar system and the galaxy.
And that contradict a naturalistic origin.
Like the spiral galaxies where their spiral form should not last even a million years, let alone the alleged billions of years that they've been there, because it's the winding up problem. The stars in the arms are not moving at a rate sufficient to keep, and we're looking at a beautiful spiral galaxy right now on Al the Seventh. My co-host the rest of the week.
You're up at 7 now.
Yeah, Al the Seventh, my notebook here, computer. And so these massive observations, not only massive black holes, but massive observations showing that the atheistic model of origins is invalid, with glaring holes and massive evidence that they're not true.
Yeah, so the spiral galaxies, if the universe really is 20 billion years old, we shouldn't see spiral galaxies.
They should have
wound up like a clock screw and be pretty much featureless. You used this, I remember, in that debate.
Yeah.
And I was surprised that they didn't answer it. Normally, they've got maybe an excuse or a story. They just didn't even deal with it.
Yeah. And this was a geophysicist and a mathematician from CU up in Boulder who are well-schooled in the arguments. In fact, the geophysicist said his best evidence for the Earth being old is the Big Bang.
Wow.
And that's often what they do. They look to other fields, and that's where they think the evidence for evolution or old Earth lies. Yeah.
But no matter how far out you look with the Hubble telescope, you see spiral galaxies. They don't start becoming featureless.
Mm. So, Fred, could we now look at the story out of Japan, the Kyoto News Report, that scientists believe that they're going to be able to clone, and it cracks me up that they call it the woolly mammoth. They should just call it a mammoth because they have no wool.
They have no wool.
They have a little bit of hair. They have no wool. And they call it that because we find them up at the Arctic Circle in Siberia and Alaska. We find them buried.
It doesn't sound good to call them the little hairy mammoths or little hair mammoths.
No. Little hairy.
The bald mammoths.
They're a little hairy mammoths. They call them woolly mammoths, but they have no wool. But that make-believe description stuck. Because how could they be up at the Arctic Circle? They would freeze to death. And so they said, well, they had wool. Well, they didn't have wool. But even if they did have wool, Fred, they have a tusk, like an elephant. And that tusk, they would lose so much heat through the tusk that one Arctic night and they would freeze to death, especially their young would freeze to death. And it's dark all winter. So they're not going to have the vegetation they need, hundreds of pounds per animal. And there's millions of these mammoths that the evidence was they lived, they were alive.
So the environment, you're saying the environment was different for the mammoths?
The environment had to be different. And the reason you could have such a massive burial of such mighty animals is that there was a global catastrophe, which we refer to as the global flood, described in the Bible in the book of Genesis.
That's right. And hey, could there possibly be a different environment before this cataclysmic event?
Yeah, very different environment. And I think Walt Brown does a fabulous job in his book, In the Beginning. Walt has a degree from MIT, and he's just a phenomenal scientist. And he explains the origin of the frozen mammoths. And this was a topic that came up in my debate with Aaron Ra, that YouTube atheist. And Fred, he was denying what creationists have often said, that there were tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or millions of mammoths that were buried.
That's right. Not that we've found those, right?
No, not
extrapolating.
Extrapolating, because, for example, mammoth tusk trade, the worldwide trade in mammoth tusks, has itself produced tons of tusks. Tons. And, in fact, thousands of tons of tusks. And so I've got a couple quotes here, including sources. And, for example, you go to a book published by the Smithsonian on frozen mammoths from Siberia bring the ice ages to vivid life. That's the title of a book by John Massey Stewart from the Smithsonian. Now, that goes back to 1977. But, Fred, he refers to the chairman of the Russian Academy of Sciences and their Committee for the Study of Mammoths. And he estimated that more than 500,000 tons.
Tons. Wow.
Of mammoth tusks were buried along one 600-mile stretch of the Arctic coast.
And Aaron Ra, he denied that.
Maybe a dozen. Yeah. He thought maybe there were a dozen. And so I said, Aaron, and I think I explained this three times. You know, we all sometimes have a hard time when we're debating, actually listening to what the other person said. But I think at the end he got it. That I said, Aaron, we have not dug up millions of frozen mammoths. Only a dozen or a couple few dozen frozen mammoth finds have been discovered. But the tonnage of tusks on the world market has shown us that there were thousands, and I said, I assert that there were over 1 million mammoths living up in or near the Arctic Circle based on the tonnage of tusks. So here is this estimate.
And they were living there before the flood, right?
Before the flood. They couldn't survive there. And the Earth, this is a bit complicated, but the Earth rolled on its axis. There's tremendous evidence for the fact that the Earth rolled on its axis. And that evidence is in Walt Brown's book, In the Beginning. We've done a show on this. You could go to realsciencefriday.com, check out our program on frozen mammoths. I think you'll love it. And so this is not a young Earth creationist. This isn't Fred Williams making an unsubstantiated claim. This is the chairman of the Russian Academy of Sciences Committee for the Study of Mammoths, who estimated that on the 600-mile stretch of Arctic coast, there was 500,000 tons of mammoth tusks buried. And Fred, the average mammoth tusk weighs about 100 pounds.
100 pounds.
Yeah.
Wow.
And there have been thousands of tons that have been on the world market. This is, but we haven't dug up every tusk.
Yeah. It's a reasonable estimate of how many of these mammoths were running around.
Right. And this estimate is 5 million mammoths. And they would need liquid water, Fred, to drink. And all winter long, they're not going to get liquid water. And they're not going to get the hundreds of pounds of vegetation they need. And so something catastrophic occurred to kill these millions of mammoths. And these are huge beasts.
Yeah, and evolutionists recognize that that they're probably part of the elephant family, right?
Yeah.
The elephant
That's
kind.
Right.
And so they're going to try to clone. They're going to take some
African elephant eggs.
That's right. And put it into an African elephant and try to clone and produce a woolly or a little-haired mammoth.
A little hair. They're going to try to produce a mammoth, which would be so extraordinary. Now, these mammoths lived until the global flood, which was just about 4,500 years ago. And so they didn't live. Now, scientists will say the ice ages and they give different dates, and they might say 10,000 or 40-some thousand years ago some of these mammoths lived. In fact, you've got a story there about proteins, right?
Yeah, there's a related story that they've found. They've extracted 126 proteins from a what they claim is a 43,000-year-old woolly mammoth.
Mm.
So, which is impressive that they've gotten that many proteins, because most of these finds that we have in the fossil record, like we've talked a lot about the T-Rex, most of the protein we find there is collagen, right? Mm-hmm. Now, they've got 126 different proteins they've now found in woolly mammoths.
From mammoths. And these are different, although one, I'm a fan of Mary Schweitzer, Dr. Schweitzer, from North Carolina State University, and she's involved in the study, right?
That's right. Yeah, she's the one who said that, who indicated that there's a recovery of a significant portion of these proteins that aren't the typical collagen-type protein that we find.
And so the reason I like her, you like her, we've been following her work for years, is that she's the first one to report in the mainstream peer-reviewed journals that they have recovered soft tissue from a T-Rex.
That's right.
And once Mary Schweitzer did that, and of course, P.Z. Myers is still saying it's not original even
material,
though
there's
a mountain of evidence, not only now from a T-Rex, but universities all over the world.
10 major universities, secular universities, that say it is original biomaterial. It's
from
not
dinosaurs. They've now done this with soft tissue from a mosasaur, which is supposedly 70 million years old, and from Archaeopteryx, which is supposedly 150 million years old, and from a hadrosaur. And so, Fred, it just goes on and on. Now that they're allowed, the taboo has been lifted, they're allowed to look for soft tissue from dinosaur. Forget about a mammoth. From dinosaurs that have been extinct for up to 100 million years or more. And they're saying, look, when we look in these bones, big bones and little tiny bones, we're finding original biological material. That is powerful evidence that the old ages are false, and that
That's
these
right.
dinosaurs were created by God in the recent past, and most of the dinosaurs were killed in a global flood just thousands of years ago. And that's why we find they have carbon-14 in them that they should not have if they're millions of years old, and proteins.
Yep. So we're going to go from a million mammoths to zero, and now maybe to one.
Wow.
If they're able to I thought it was kind of funny. There's a gambling place that has odds on them being able to sequence this. Like,
yeah, you could go online and bet whether or not they're going to be able to
clone. How quick they'll be able to do it. Like, within a year, it's like 8-1, and it's 5-2 if they can get it by within 5 years, which is their goal. They
and what are the odds that Tebow is going to win yet again on Sunday? You could bet on that, too. But Tim Tebow will be quarterbacking this Sunday at home.
At home.
For the Broncos.
We'll be there cheering them on.
And there is a science story I decided to skip. I don't know if you saw.
So every radio show talks about Tebow, so we're keeping up the tradition.
That's right.
Right.
Well, there's a science show that scientists have said that Tebow's passing could improve, even with his stunning record of victories, that he could get better as a passer scientifically, but we don't have to cover that.
Okay.
Of course he could improve, right?
Yeah.
This is his first 10 games as an NFL starting quarterback, he's won 7 out of 10.
Won 7 out of 10, and he threw 68% in college, but yet he's an inaccurate passer.
Yes.
I
and he won the Heisman Trophy.
I think there's a bias against him.
But yeah. It's a lot of fun. All right. So, Fred, the mammoth cloning is coming. Hopefully that would be so neat to see. Proteins, they're finding them now by the scores of proteins. And they're finding soft tissue in dinosaurs and Archaeopteryx and everything else. The tusk tonnage, Aaron Ra, even though it was a minor point, he was wrong on that. He was confused, as in many of the claims he makes in his Foundational Falsehoods of Creation video series. How about this? Can we talk about the Richard Dawkins Color Vision Challenge that we want to issue from Real Science Friday? It would be like our second challenge, because we already issued the P.Z. Myers Trochlea Challenge.
Yeah, so now we've got the Trichromatic Challenge.
Yeah, so this is going to be fun. Now, doesn't Darwin, and in fact Richard Dawkins, say that the eye could evolve by small steps?
Yes, the little steps. What's his book, Mount Improbable? One step upon another step upon another step.
Yeah.
Slowly over time can create a lot of different features, like the eye, which is silly to the 100th millionth degree. But anyways.
So climbing Mount Improbable he says that, look, evolution cannot scale the face of a cliff and yeah, make hopeful. This it's giant
not,
leap.
It's not going to do the hopeful monster.
Right. But it'll come up the backside of the cliff, climbing Mount Improbable one small step at a time.
One small mistake at a time.
One small mistake at a time.
I mean, that's how silly the argument is.
Yeah, to right make is. A vision system.
Yeah.
So there are so many problems with making a vision system. Like, for example, people think when you're looking at something, like let's say a fly is looking at a flower. They think that inside the fly's brain, there's a little projector, and it's showing the flower. But it's not. It would look like static on your TV screen if it looked like anything.
Yeah.
It's a constant flow of electrochemical signals that are logically bunched up into information packets that are changing 1,000 times a second, and they have to be unpacked and decoded.
That's right.
Logically.
Yeah.
And the laws of physics have no logic functions, so physics couldn't do any of that. It's the wrong tool to try to explain a vision system. But nevertheless, Charles Darwin and Richard Dawkins say that by tiny little incremental steps that even something as complex as the eye could develop. Well, Real Science Friday, we're producing a challenge to that, and we'd like your input. You can email us.
And we're going to tie our arms behind our back, right? We're going to give them monochronic vision, which is itself a huge advantage. Yeah,
that's right. We're going to give them like black and white, grayscale vision.
Yep.
So
black
you know
and white
how we
TV.
Have rods
we're
and
gonna
cones?
We're going to give them the 1950s TV.
Yeah, that's right. You know how you have rods and cones?
Yep.
And the rods are your monochromatic black and white, and the cones are color vision. Well, let's say you have a creature that has monochromatic vision.
So just black and white.
Black and white. And you want to introduce dichromatic. So now he could distinguish a color, not only black and white gradation like grayscale, but now a color like red or green or blue. Now, what is the tiny steps between monochromatic and dichromatic?
Well, I know how humans did it. Oh. You remember those black and white TVs and you could buy that screen that had a blue at the top and green at the bottom? And that gave you your color TV.
Fred, I'm not that old. I don't remember that.
It was a silly invention.
How old are you?
I'm 50, the big 50.
And I'm 50 also.
Yeah, so you missed out.
I'm 50.
I think I saw it on an episode of Happy Days.
Yeah, okay. I don't remember that thing. I never liked the fun, so I never got to see that growing up. But, Fred, we have this huge step in an engineering challenge to go from monochromatic to dichromatic. There are no logical steps in between that would grant a survival advantage to an organism that's putting together the thousands of pieces of equipment and infrastructure and circuitry and all the logical packing up of data in a different way and unpacking it. There's just no survival advantage to bring you through the thousands of steps necessary to go from monochromatic to dichromatic.
Yeah, and to get to trichromatic, think of how many more steps you got to get, you know, the full color.
Right. And so that's the challenge when Richard Dawkins says that the eye can evolve because it could go in tiny little steps. Yep. We're going to challenge him. Now, we need an artist to draw a sketch like we had the trochlea challenge. Drawn.
Yep.
Beautiful diagram. And so we'll do a rough drawing. So if there's an artist out there who'd like to help Real Science Friday, we could use your help. Please volunteer. You could email us. Fred, what's your email?
Fred@evolutionfairytale.com.
All right. And I'm Bob@kgov.com, KGOV.com. And so you could volunteer or you can call us at 1-800-8-NYART. Volunteer as an artist. And also, if you have thoughts on this challenge, this Dawkins Color Vision Challenge, please feel free to email them to Fred or me, or they could go to your forum, right, Fred?
Yeah, at evolutionfairytale.com.
That's right. And of course, every Real Science Friday, you could comment on each show. Just go to realsciencefriday.com, click on the show title and comments, and you'll be commenting on our website, TheologyOnline.com.
That's right.
So, Fred, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Tonight is Rocky Mountain Creation Fellowship. May God bless you all.
Have you heard of the little church that could? Join Pastor Bob Enyart at Denver Bible Church for Sunday school at 9:30 a.m., worship service from 10:50 until noon, and our Sunday evening Bible study at 6 p.m. Located at Two Roads School at 7180 Oak Street in Arvada, Colorado. Join us on Sundays as we study the meat of the Word of God, to worship our awesome Creator and to equip the saints for the service of the Lord.